Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to One Broken Mom. If you're getting surprised by these new episodes popping up between the seasons, well, you can thank a pandemic for that. I had meant to start season three on Mother's Day, as always was the plan. But of course, as I wrapped up season two in February, we all found ourselves in an entirely life-changing situation and dealing with a whole lot of conditions that none of us ever saw coming, none of us would have expected. And it's been a growing process, you know, for people worldwide. And so because of working in the field of mental health, self-improvement, self-awareness, human behavior, and all that, blah, 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 it seems really important to that instead of sticking to such a hard schedule that I had to be able to bring in people that I've met over the last 2 years, experts that you guys really like listening to and respect tremendously, and to have us have these conversations about what's going on right now for many of us from our different perspectives. And so Liz Cohen is one of them that you guys have heard before. She and I have talked about toxic families. We've talked about how to handle toxic families during the holidays. And Liz is, finishing up a book right now. But has been on the show also talking about divorce and how to master your divorce and how to glow from your divorce and how to get by it. So you can imagine that anybody who did not know they were going to be trapped at home, and I use that word because I think that's the feeling that we're, you know, some of us are really experiencing very, very strongly right now. That might have been in either the within already an uncomfortable relationship that divorce was a very strong consideration, and now you're like the doors have closed around you and you're with this person, or like what Liz works with a lot and talks with a lot is a lot of women that are ending and coming out and going through divorce. Now, what does that mean for us and our well-being when we find ourselves, you know, kind of sequestered off from the community? And so we're here to talk. Liz is here with me right now. And we're going to tackle this, this balance of the stress already and the trauma of divorce, which is a traumatic experience. Even if you want it, it hurts. With now the trauma of a hyper-aroused danger system, because there's also this pandemic and being forced to do things that we didn't have to worry about before, and kind of throws us off of our balance. So Liz, thank you very much for being here. She and I have struggled to get the date set because we've all been busy. Outside of this, obviously, you know, Liz, you've been busy with your practice. And also you're in New York, but not right now, right? You're like, you got out of New York, but we started here in Washington in the beginning of the epicenter, and now it's no longer, the heat isn't on us as much as it is, but now you're up in the upper Northeast dealing with the epicenter of the coronavirus and the COVID pandemic. So how's that been for you, like personally?
Yeah, well, as you say it, I have chills because I'm a born and bred New Yorker. So it brings tears to my eyes because my home is under attack. Mm-hmm. And so the identification with a place that is so deeply, I am so deeply identified with being under attack, is incredibly painful. And I allow myself to feel this fear and this sadness and notice the constriction in my body because it's essential. It's part of me. I, as you mentioned, we've all been really busy, so it would be really easy for me to push it away. We are fortunate enough to be in our home in Pennsylvania, which is more rural. So I could think, well, I'm not there. It's not happening to me. But I'm allowing myself to feel the feelings of sadness and grief and really despair for my city.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, as you say this, you know, all of us listening here, you know, we only need to go back 10 years and we go back to 9/11, right? Like, I mean, you know, actually it's not 10 years, it's almost 20 years. This is like how the brain fog, right? But yeah, you know, let's go back in time. You know, New York has been under attack in our lifetime, in our consciousness, in our adult lives, right? So is there something to the fact that many people in that community have already had to deal with the terror of attack and the fear of what's next to then have to be re-triggered by the pandemic itself and the coronavirus itself?
It's really a great question, Ami. I think you're bringing up a really important part about trauma, and that as what the research shows about trauma is that your reaction to any one is impacted by kind of the overlap of how many have been there before. And so if you think about, and I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to mention this, that we're going through a trauma, as you said, of the existential fear of threat to our survival and our lives. And that is on top of any sort of personal traumas you might have had, any systemic oppression you've had. So if you're part of the LGBTQA population, if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, you know, you're already starting with this trauma of having felt this fear and this threat. So specifically, I'll share my experience as someone who grew up I was born in 1975 in New York City. Living in the New York City in the 80s was traumatic. It was very scary. There was hypervigilance all the time. There was a sense of danger. So that's kind of the first layer, not to mention, as we talked about in the toxic families, I came to with my own trauma with my own family. So I was inside, so then outside. So then 9/11, right? And then the pandemic. So there is a layering for me as a New Yorker, and I'm sure for many New Yorkers who've lived through 9/11. And I think about like the first responders. You know, a lot of the first responders right now are the same first responders from 9/11 and lost so many people. So it's profound, the traumatic experiences that are happening in my city and likely other places. And I've spoken to a number of therapists, and we're all kind of holding our breath because the amount of trauma that we will have to face and help people heal is going to be monumentous. It's just going to be huge. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, because it's really important that your audience understand this, that we as therapists and as healers are going to help people process and heal the trauma later. This is not the time to start trying to process it. We're still in it right now as we're recording. So it's not the time to be processing, finding a silver lining, understanding where you're moving with this, you know, where this is going. It's simply to stabilize. We don't want yet to start processing. You don't process during the trauma. So we just hold a lot of space to allow the feelings and we do some stabilization.
Mm, that's a great point to bring up because I think a lot of people are struggling to control the situation, right? Like the trauma triggers whatever our survival, you know, instincts were and that we learned, you know, and if you have a lot of dysfunction, you know, you've learned a lot of different strategies. And, you know, we are trying to, some people are, you know, very fearful and very withdrawn because they're surviving it, but trying to pull themselves up and out of it, right? Like, you know, feeling like there's some pressure to rise above it, to become resilient above it or whatever. And then, you know, we see people that are fighting against it, fighting against misinformation, whatever side of the political coin they're on, the other side is wrong right now, you know? And then trying to, you know, feel, I've seen this, you know, this communicated out with people feeling really surprised at, again, And I think the other episode that I did, I talked about this with my other guest, Wendy Bahari, who's out in the Northeast as well. You know, that there's this shock of like, I can't believe I'm triggered so easily. Like, I don't understand why my emotions are right at the surface level. You know, I should know better, you know, and somehow this, then the guilt and shame that comes around with being dysregulated and not feeling, because I think sometimes people don't know they're stressed because they've done such a good job at, in the past, of adapting to it and kind of bowing to it or bending with it, that we don't get the first tip off there's something wrong until we've actually like snapped at somebody or just broke down crying or find ourselves embroiled in a fight with somebody and then going, what the heck, why am I doing this? You know, like, where did this come from?
I think one thing in particular that's happening now, Ami, is that a lot of the behaviors we could engage in to distract us from our feelings are no longer there. So, you know, getting in an argument, let's say with your partner, and then, you know, going for a ride and going to Starbucks and getting a coffee, you know, being able to, that's kind of a small one, or, you know, throwing yourself into your work and staying late and having meetings and having happy hours. So the avoidance strategies that we used to do to avoid our feelings, I think we have less of them. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that people are really being faced with themselves. I just have this thought of like being, I've never been more familiar with my closet, because I feel like I spend, you know, it's like there's not a lot of choices anymore. The choices are like what you have in your closet. So I like know my closet. I know my fridge. I know my pantry, like better than I've ever known them before. And in some ways it's the same with the feelings. It's like, wow, I'm really feeling these feelings now in a way that I can't run away from them. Even though people can, you know, can try, because I am very concerned. I just want to say to everyone who's listening, there's a real desire to escape with alcohol and substances. And I get it. Like, after a really long day of really hard work and parenting and doing it all at the same time, like a glass of wine seems like such a great idea. I just want to remind people that why alcohol and substances are depressants. So they do impact your mood, even if in the short term they feel good. And right now, as I said, with stabilization, we have to be so careful. Our nervous systems are, you know, raw and firing. They need so much care. So I know it's really hard, but I'm really recommending that people limit or don't do it at all.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you know, you're bringing up another, I think, salient point to this whole thing, which is why, you know, when I thought about like, how do I title this episode, you know, the word trapped was really important for me, because there are a lot of people that feel like that is the essence of it, you know, being, you know, why you see so many people, like at this point when we are recording this is late April, we've begun to see protests around the country because the stay-at-home orders are feeling very confining to people. And so there's a lot of reasons why people feel like, you know, we need to kind of revolt against whatever the situation is. But it may actually be like, I know there's economic things. And so when I say these things, we're not dismissing any of the reasons that people come up with, but it is a feeling of being trapped that is very scary, like at a primal level for people that, you know, being confined and not being able to do it under your terms and under your conditions is probably the root of all of this that makes this very unsettling for anybody. And nobody would have thought this would have been the strategy moving forward, right? Like, we never imagined this scenario, this world scenario that we'd all actually be in. We saw it on movies and, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of processed it. But the reality of being trapped in these situations is very hard mm-hmm. for everybody, but probably more so for people that now find themselves trapped with a person they could routinely escape from or was considering escaping from, you know, in terms of like ending a relationship. Talk a little bit about that.
I think you're absolutely right about that word. When I was studying somatic experiencing, there was a whole section that we learned about people who had a trauma of being trapped or suffocated. And that can be physically, or it can also be emotionally. Mm-hmm. So we have to remember, and I try to remember this when I'm watching people saying they want to step out and they can't stand being inside anymore, that it's likely triggering something from the past for them. You know, that there's this, it is really difficult to stay inside. And it's even harder if you've had that experience before and not really processed the fact that you're free. Like if you're felt trapped all the time anyway, and now your environment matches how you feel, that can be really intense. So that's what I think is happening for a lot of people there. The women that I work with who are in relationships where either they've been considering divorce and we're getting ready, or in the middle of a divorce, the trap feeling is unbelievable. I mean, there's anyone who's in the process of getting divorced or considering divorce is just overwhelmed with a sense of being trapped. The courts are closed. There's no movement. Mediators aren't moving forward. So there is, I mean, one thing that you know probably from your divorce too, is that any sort of little movement felt like a success because you were moving away from having felt trapped in the relationship, you know, for probably a long time, even before you decided to leave. Mm-hmm. So this kind of pause or this frozen state for people who are really unsure in their relationship or wanting to leave it can be intolerable. It can feel like you want to crawl out of your skin.
Yeah. Well, and I think too that, you know, again, from experience, that once you have finally made the mental leap that you're going to end it, that was huge. That was a gap the size of the Grand Canyon to get to that point. Like, you know, the choice to end the relationship, even if it's not divorce, all of us have been through this. We've all been strained by breakups, even when they're the right things to do, it's still hard to break connection. And so then to go that, like, I'm ready for this, like I'm emotionally there, and then like have that door just slammed in your face, right. You know, that's so
with someone who's also triggered by the trauma while you're triggered by the trauma. So I always tell, I've been telling people recently that I want you to think about every person you have contact with in your home right now as being one of those spinning plates that you see at the circus on a pole. Yeah. That is their nervous system spinning, spinning, spinning. And then another one comes in, spinning, 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 spinning. You know, and then another one. And by the way, pets are included. They have their own nervous system. So it's almost impossible. And this is what I've been talking to my clients about, that it is impossible to do any of this perfectly. It is a messy, unclear, uncertain time. And so I have been suggesting what I mentioned before about really allowing yourself to feel the feelings and giving yourself an enormous hall pass, I'm calling it, an enormous permission slip. For sure, sometimes you talk to your partner who you're getting a divorce with or breaking up with kindly and with love, and sometimes you scream at them. It's all okay. Mm-hmm. Adding any sort of pressure about how you're supposed to act is just going to collapse you into more trauma and more pain. This is completely unprecedented. How you're doing it, how your neighbor's doing it, is going to be different. What I can help people do is let go of this feeling that they're supposed to be doing it in a certain way and that they're failing. Mm-hmm. I hear that so often. So just releasing that. And then something else you mentioned earlier, Ami, about the guilt. I've been talking with people about being able to have more than one feeling at a time. So you can have guilt. Let's say that you're the one who asked for the divorce, and now your partner is living with you and wants you back. You can feel guilt about that. And at the same time, you can feel grateful for having made the decision that you made. You can feel guilty and recognize your privilege that you live in this beautiful home and can isolate. And you can feel grateful for what you have. I call it the golden and. We need to allow ourselves to have more than one feeling at a time. So if you feel trapped, that's okay. You can feel trapped and also joyful. You can feel constricted and alive. You know, trauma, when we're in a trauma state, and you know this well, you can only feel one feeling. It's very rigid. It's the tunnel vision. And so I'm encouraging people to be able to feel into the difficulty and any other feelings that might be coming up as well. That's mm-hmm. the flexibility in the trauma mind that and trauma brain that we want to instill.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like that would be, I imagine that the, you know, the folks that you're talking with may really be struggling with having that permission to do that. Just because sometimes, you know, our traumas are from coming from places of emotional neglect or emotional immaturity. And, you know, there was no flexibility in an emotion without, you know, a consequence to that, you know, being able to be mad and then, you know, and then feeling guilty that you got mad. So, you know, and it sounds like what you're saying is like, that's all normal and that's going to be, that'll be fine. But, you know, how do you get somebody that, to have that graciousness with themselves? You know, how do you reinforce them being able to do that with themselves? Because I think that there's a lot of people that really are, you know, like you said, getting to know their emotional closets right now. Like you said, physical closet, I agree. Like I know my 10 sweatpants that I keep wearing over and over again very well. But there is the emotional closet that we're all sitting there going, wow, like I didn't expect any of this. You know, how do I come to terms with that regularly and not be overwhelmed by that?
Yeah. So I think similarly to the closet, this is a coming home. It's reminding me actually, do you know the Rumi poem, The Guest House?
I know Rumi. I don't know that poem off the top of my head though.
I'm pretty sure it's a Rumi poem. It's a beautiful poem and it starts with, treat all your feelings as if they are guests in your house, arriving at your front door. And I actually suggest to clients sometimes to set a table as if you're inviting people for dinner, but the place cards are the feelings. So it can be all the feelings. So of course, everyone first writes down joy, happiness, excitement, pleasure, no, also sadness, rage, fear, sorrow, grief. And thinking about opening your body, opening your home to all of them, that they are here, and that, as I feel like I say every day now, research shows that when you look at an MRI, the excitation of the emotions are all the same. It's our interpretation of them and how we try to manage them that impact the valence of them. So inviting them all, they're all equal. They're all coming to teach and show us something. And they're meant to be here. I talk with clients also about, you can't be whole or full without all of your emotions. Another metaphor I use in my program is a bicycle wheel. That if you draw a bicycle wheel, you need many spokes. You can't just have the spokes of joy, excitement, love, support. You also have to have irritability and frustration. You have to have all of the spokes so that bicycle wheel will move. And so you are the beauty of all of who you are. And if you feel like stress or fear or anger is derailing you, it's likely because you don't have enough of a relationship with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're kind of pushing it off and dismissing it or, you know, or afraid of it, right?
Exactly. And it's hard. I mean, I'm saying this as it's easy. I mean, it's an everyday practice. It is not something you do overnight. It's uncomfortable. When I started doing this work, I just put my hand to my heart and labeled the emotion like fear and just noticed it. Mm-hmm. And then what typically happens is the fear doesn't attach once you recognize it. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And that's common. I mean, we talk about that, you know, outside of pandemic, you know, situations that once you bring an awareness to the front, right. And I'm pointing at my forehead here because this is, you know, mm-hmm. frontal cortex, this is your objectivity, right? Once you're able to kind of disassociate and look at it as if you're a third person saying you're feeling afraid right now, then you're like, oh, I am. And then you get to be curious about it, and you get to, you know, think about it and reflect on it and wonder about it, you know, not solve it necessarily. You might solve it right through that process there, but yeah, it instantly neutralizes it, right? Like and that's, you know, that is brain science right there that we talk about, which is why I nerd out on that like all a lot.
Yes,
like
it's so good, right?
It's brain science.
Right. And during the pandemic, it's even more important to be bringing online, as I like to call it, the frontal cortex, because when we're going through a trauma, the amygdala, the emotional part of the brain, and the frontal cortex aren't able to communicate as well because the amygdala is getting flooded with cortisol. So the more we can activate the thinking part of our brain, we joked earlier about, you know, brain fog. I mean, I call it COVID brain. Like we literally aren't problem solving as well. And so we need to bring an intention to do that. So one thing I can say is that, you know, if you're just starting out figuring out how you feel, take your emotional temperature in the morning and at night. Take your emotional temperature, write down how sad, angry, scared, happy, hopeful you are from 0 to 10. Just take your temperature, just start noticing it. Just bringing your awareness to the fact that those feelings might be part of your experience. And I guarantee if you keep track of that, and if you were to plot it on a graph, you would see how it goes in waves. And by being able to see the wave activity of your feelings, you can bring a sense of ease to when you notice them coming up because you know they come and they go.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's like knowing when the mail is going to be delivered every day, right? Like it suddenly it becomes an expectation and it becomes a part, like not a surprise, right? Like you're no longer surprised by them. You're no longer, pent up by them.
Exactly. Now,
And I love that because I do think, you know, again, when we have trauma histories, you know, the results of therapy, honestly, are not that they go away, right? But that we learn how to neutralize the instant and instantaneous impacts that they have on our lives, you know, because we, you know, our survival skills are so hyper-triggered into dealing with like everything is a traumatic experience, right? So, you know, outside of pandemics, you know, for people that are listening and why we listen and why we talk about this is that we can't make it go away. Sometimes we can, but really what we're talking about doing is learning how to neutralize it as soon as it does try to take over and recognize it for what it is. That's a memory. Mm-hmm. That's a history. That's a brain script that's there. But now we know that it's there, and you can only do that by identifying that that's what's really going on, to take that very compassionate third party look at it.
And you mentioned the word predictable, and predictable is like a fight against trauma, right? Because trauma is unpredictable. Mm-hmm. So when you feel like something is predictable, it's a salve to the trauma state because you're actually able to know what's happening next.
And I, you know, and we do this like outside of this, like outside of the world, this has so many other benefits because, you know, when we step out of this whole experience and it will end, you know, it's going to end. We don't know when, we don't know how, but this will come to an end. Right. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to go back into the world. We're going to have this trauma history, a part of the memory system that we deal with. And we're going to still have uncomfortable situations. There's going to be discomfort presented to us. There's going to be anger, sadness, whatever it may be. You know, this is a skill that we can actually bring out into the rest of our lives by learning how to set an expectation. Like, I'm getting ready to go do something that is probably going to make me afraid. I'm getting ready to go have a conversation that's probably going to get the other person angry at me. How am I going to respond to that? How am I going to address it? How am I going to adapt to that? And so this value, you know, the upsides, you know, always, you know, we're always trying to frame an upside here, but like you said, wait till after the trauma is over to really get into that. But, you know, there is an upside to this of being able to become intimate with that emotional closet is that we can then take, these are skills we'll need and continue to grow from.
100%. I heard someone say recently that this trauma is pointing like a golden arrow at the areas that you needed to work on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So whatever you learn now about how to tolerate your feelings, absolutely, it will help you in your life and it will help you get through whatever the transition is to getting out of there, of this. It's interesting when you said we will get out of this. You know, I think that's something I've been saying to a lot of my trauma clients a lot. Mm-hmm. Because remember, the trauma brain is afraid it will never get out of this.
100%. Right. Yeah. We think that we're doomed. Right. Yeah. And you're actually, I mean, 100%. Yeah. Right. You have to be reminded that this too shall pass, and not to sound all wishy-washy, but it really does. Like, even our old trauma is still back there behind us. We survived that.
Exactly. That's something that we have to say so often, right? Because the nervous system can feel in the moment as if that's what trauma is. The trauma is still happening. And so remembering that you lived through that trauma, you're having a trigger, you will move through this as well. And another piece that I've really recommended to people is looking at the people that you feel like are taking care of this. Whether it's someone from the CDC, whether it's someone from the WHO, whether it's a scientist you read, think about the people who have been training their whole life for this and are taking care of it, especially if you have developmental trauma where you grew up in a home with neglect or abuse. You're going to be deeply triggered when it feels like there's a lot of chaos on the top. And so you want to constantly remind yourself that there are grown-ups in charge, and they are going to help us get through this. And to talk to your little nervous system in that way, because again, you know, you might think, you said this earlier, like, why don't I know that? Well, because I'm triggered, because I lived through a time where I brilliantly figured out how to survive when grownups weren't in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I wanted to make sure that we touched on this because, you know, there are people in unsafe situations at home right now. And you know, despite all of this, coming to tune with our emotions, and I'm not dismissing any of that, right? But I, you know, imagine like you sitting down and having time to, you know, to invite all the emotions in. There's no place to do that. Like some people are sitting at home in a very uncomfortable situation with a person that they literally can't leave from and escape from, being re-traumatized by this on top of the pandemic. This doesn't necessarily mean that we're dealing with domestic violence or relational abuse, but it can be a part of it. But how do you escape when you can't escape?
Because
we're talking about people that right before they were told they couldn't go anywhere were ready to leave, and now they're not, and now again we're coming back to this trap thing. So how do you escape when you can't escape the situation?
So I think the most important thing is to remember what you felt about your agency and your power before this happened, to really touch into your internal strength. I work with a group of therapists who deal with narcissistic abuse, and it's very concerning, the people we know who are trapped in those relationships. Mm-hmm. And especially because a typical narcissist can really shift one's reality. And when you're already vulnerable in this traumatic time, it can be intensely damaging. And so we've been helping clients really secure a boundary around themselves. Sometimes it's a physical boundary, a place in your house where you can go, bathtub, where you can have your own space to check in with what's happening for you. Limiting contact. You know, there's no rule that because we're all home together, it means we're all interacting all the time. So we're really trying to help people connect to them, to not lose themselves in this situation, even though it can be so difficult. So with clients of mine and my colleagues, we're really trying to say, okay, so, what are the behaviors you're doing throughout the day, and what can we shift? So it's not necessarily, you're not basically giving over your power. But if you're dealing with someone who in narcissistic abuse, you also have to be proactive. You also have to be doing things that are not necessarily triggering the other person. And so you have to be on a lot of the time. It's awful. It's really difficult. And I, I mean, I would recommend if anybody felt like they were in that situation to get help, because it's too much to bear on their own. So to get help from a coach or a therapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that actually, as soon as you say the word, my skin crawls, my chest tightens, you know, because I, you know, there's a lot of things for me to be grateful for. And that is to not be in a situation like that anymore, because I can't even imagine what things would be like right now. And I think that the situation that's going on outside of us, external to us, that we're watching in many ways has been, I know personally, has been triggering for me, because when I'm watching gaslighting and I'm watching this narrative being twisted and turned around, you know, and I usually resist politics, and I'm going to resist a political statement here on the show, because I know that everybody comes from different faiths and different political stances that listen to us, because we all have trauma. That's our unifying character here. But sometimes what we're seeing in the behaviors and actions of other people out there can be re-triggering for us if we've dealt with abusive situations. And I know for me personally, that has been one of the things that I've found myself finally just like going, I can't even imagine, you know. And I've, you know, said to people, like, if you want to know what, you know, emotional abuse looks like, you might all be feeling it in some way, shape, or another, because you are feeling the sense of somebody else trying to persuade you of a reality that is in conflict with what you believe or what you think is really going on. And so to be in a home right now with somebody, that is abusive in that way, who's also triggered, of course, right? So their own nature is also like has heaps of gasoline poured on top of it. I'm grateful to not be there right now, but I have tremendous like concern and sympathy and empathy for men and women that are in it right now. Yeah. You know, I feel like, you know, people need to be given some permission though, that just because you have a stay at home order doesn't mean you have to stay in a domestically abusive situation though.
Like, right. I think you need to understand that, you know, coercive narcissism and aggressive narcissism is abuse. And I've read about some organizations where if you go to the grocery store there, you know, there's a sign that says, you know, you can make a call here, you can get some help. And there are therapists who specialize in working with narcissistic abuse. Anyone wants information from me, I'm happy to give that to them, and ways to keep yourself safe. Because we need you to be your best self. We need you to be connected to that amazing part of you that I know you all have. And so if there's anything that's keeping you from that, and you can't connect to what you need and how you feel because of another person, we need to get you some help.
Yeah. And I like that suggestion there, because I thought about this, you know, before my conversation with you, is, you know, reaching out and getting help with a therapist or coach is actually an act of warfare against a narcissistic partner. So where do you go in your house where you can have a conversation like this, even on a telehealth session, that you may not actually end up having somebody who is feeling very attacked by the fact that you were going out and doing something like that, and that you may be talking about them, right? Like, and so you mentioned a grocery store, like, I hadn't even thought about that. Like, but it seems like people, you know, again, I guess I wanted to make this sentiment that you don't, just because there's a stay-at-home order, don't feel like you cannot still escape the abusive situation. There are resources out there. And, you know, yes. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a little bit of research. I'm going to attach it to the show notes for this show of links people can, if they still feel like, you know, you don't have to tolerate the abuse just because the government said you need to stay home for a little bit. Like, you know, there are going to be safe resources. And so I will do a little bit of digging and I'll attach it onto this. And then if you have any therapists that are working with that, because I think that people still need to know that trapped doesn't mean really trapped. Trapped is a sense, it is a feeling, right? That some of us are used to having from trauma. And it gives us this, I think, this sense that we really can't do anything. Because again, that's the trauma response. I'm stuck. I can't get out of it. But you can, in an extreme situation, and still should do it, yeah. Right? I mean, I hope that that's still the recommendation. Now, what happens when, not to switch gears, I don't want this to feel like, you know, but we're trying to cover a lot within about an hour here. So I do want to switch gears. I don't want to just like drop that very important conversation that we just had there, but I do wanted to, you know, I wanted to dial in with you that, you know, congratulations to all the newly divorced people who now are stuck at home and can't go out and meet people. Like, how are those people you know, that you're talking to that are like, yay, I got out. But now I'm like this whole nother sense of, well, you know, now how do I handle like my freedom I don't actually have right now, you know? So
So one of the interesting biggest issues that's been coming up that I've noticed is how to deal with co-parenting during the, if you have children, during the pandemic, especially given the stay-at-home orders. And it's been a very interesting experience and very individual for each couple, depending on how much communication, how much safety you feel. You know, in an ideal situation, you and your partner, it would be a similar, I've been equating it with the conversations about consent. So it would be a conversation where your partner was very clear about who they're seeing and what their contact is going to be when they're not with the kids, and then who they're going to be exposing the kids to when they're with the kids, and you would be sharing your, you know, plan, and you could come to an agreement. That's an ideal situation. Many people are not in that situation. Mm-hmm. And the women I've worked with have really struggled with, you know, do they pull their kids from the visits or the custody agreement and keep them in one home? Or do they, you know, risk the kids and exposure? And what's interesting about this is also their exposure. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if the kids come back, it's not the same kind of situation I talk about with co-parenting where you can't really control what the other person's doing, but it does directly impact you. So that's been a really difficult, complicated conversation for people. It's also been interesting because it's been changing, which I think is one of the muscles we're being pushed to exercise during this time, which is flexibility. So I've been saying to people, you know, what worked last week might not be the same that works this week. Mm-hmm. And so having to be flexible with that, but it's been difficult. It's also required some people I work with to speak up in a way they haven't before in their post-divorce life. So that's been interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a woman in my program who just met someone dating. So you're saying about, and that's been a big discussion about, does she see him? Does he come over? What are the balances? You know, I keep saying to my clients who, you know, come to me and ask, you know, do you think I should do this? That in the situation we're in, there's always some sort of loss. Like there isn't a great decision either way. And it makes me realize how much we walk around this world thinking there's like a good and a bad and a right and a wrong, because really there's always loss to some decision. But I think just given, of course, as we're going through a trauma, there's this feeling of what something's right, something's wrong. We're trying to follow the rules. But there's this flexibility that I think in some ways, maybe I'm wondering, like divorced families are dealing with in a way more than other families, of having to really be flexible and like dig deep into what's okay for me and what do I want to do. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I felt when I got divorced, that it really kind of accelerated me and the kids having to really be independent or think about each other. It was just like really like an accelerant to what I thought I would only have to be thinking about when they got older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and mental flexibility, you know, is not something everyone is naturally born with. Again, that comes down to, you know, those experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, some people are, you know, learned to be far more mentally flexible with changing circumstances and rolling with the punches. And, you know, and I will say this as, again, as a person that works with the, you know, kind of the dynamics of lots of people together and understanding, you know, becoming educated and informed on, again, human behavior, you know, there is no right or wrong way. It is just our way. It's our wiring that we got. And it can be difficult for people who are naturally driven to not be mentally flexible. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, again, I want to say this in a way that I'm making this very clear. Mental flexibility isn't a sign of intelligence. It isn't a sign of courage. It's not a sign of resiliency. It doesn't mean you're better or worse than somebody. The fact that you can be flexible and somebody else can't be. I've had to say that, you know, to many people, like that's not what that means, but it is a true skill set. It is a drive, like of the big five personality factors, you know, what we've identified as a thing. And some people, through all of that trauma, either became really attached to consistency and predictability and structure. And on the other end of the spectrum, and I'm one of these people on the other end of the spectrum, what we learned was you had to go with the flow in order to survive. And when you have those things all coming in, these survival skills coming in together, it is very challenging, you know, and it's a huge ball of stress on top of it. And like what you're saying is that I think one of the, like 50% of us out here that are not in the super roll with the punches thing are really struggling against the fact that we're being stretched to become mentally flexible because there is no solid answer. Like you said, what's important this week? Like last week it was, you know, gosh, you're going to show symptoms and yeah, that's how you're going to identify, you know, who's got it and who doesn't, to all the way of, holy crap, half of us may have already have it and we have no symptoms. Oh, you know, nail biting here. And you just, you know, getting confronted with, you know, now what? I don't know. Like I thought I had this figured out. Now I don't know how to figure that out. So how do you counsel somebody or coach somebody through that may be in the, I really am not driven for mental flexibility. How do I do this in a way that doesn't, you know, that is successful, but yet also doesn't, you know, overstress my nervous system even more, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I think that what we mentioned earlier about if you're not able to connect to mental flexibility, it's likely, as you said, because of a traumatic response, like it was a survival. So I would do some work on you survived that, like you survived whatever the trauma you went through, and then the lack of mental flexibility, the structure, the rigidity, that worked great then. That was so great. And I would really kind of distinguish then versus now, which is that now you can always use your structure and your, you know, rigidity if we need it. But right now there's some other people who are doing that work. And what you need to do now is to really be more flexible. And what's different between now and then that can allow you to be flexible? You couldn't be flexible before because there was no grown-ups in charge. Now, let you know, give me a list of three people that you feel safe with. So it's really kind of separating out that the survival strategy of lack of mental flexibility made sense then, but now maybe we can let it be on the side for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah. And, you know, and again, we always talk about guilt and shame. Yeah. Your lack of ability today to suddenly switch on a dime and turn into somebody that you just haven't been, you know, your momentum has been carrying you forward in your life in one way or another. It's not going to suddenly change right away. It is going to take practice to be able to do it. And you will get there if you continue to practice, right? If you keep lifting weights, your muscles will grow. Yeah. If you don't.
And we want to let that part of you that's very structured and not mentally flexible know that we're not saying you should go away. We still need you. Mm-hmm. And because it gets very threatened. The survival mechanism gets very threatened if it feels like we're dissuaging it and pushing it away. So we're going to need it, not in this specific situation, but we're going to need it soon. Mm-hmm. So it's not being totally disavowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And, you know, and the communication part too, with, you know, boundaries and expressing them. Again, it's scary to begin with. It's scarier to do now. And then, you know, there is this reality of, you know, how receptive the other person will be because they're also amplified as well. I sense that and feel that, and we all feel that, right? Like it's okay that this is all terrifying. You know,
yeah, you don't have to make, yeah, exactly. And you don't have to make huge strides and do huge, amazing, big things during this time. It's all about, again, it's all about stabilization. It's not about, you know, setting the best boundaries you've ever had or trying to push in a way that you haven't done before. Like it's not time for new, it's time to practice muscles that you can, but it's not time to like bust out of the gate with a new, totally new way of being. So how you're being is fine and beautiful and perfect. And just give yourself the permission to be that way.
That's great. Now, is there anything that you'd like to kind of like your, you know, send everybody off on this episode to take with them and kind of chew on them for, you know, for the week and the rest of the weekend or whenever they're listening to this?
Yeah. I want to offer two suggestions, two strategies that I find really helpful during this difficult time. The first one is to take a minute whenever you can notice, you can do this now if you want, kind of notice where you are being held. So notice the contact between you and the chair you're in, or if you're walking, between your feet and the floor. And just see if you can find in your body a place that you feel okay. Doesn't have to be perfect or relaxed, but you feel okay, okay to neutral. And for some people, it might be a part of their body that's a big part. But for some of my clients, sometimes it's just like the tip of their nose, just a part that feels okay. And as you bring your attention to that, you'll probably notice some parts that don't feel okay. That's fine too. We'll just bring our attention back to a part that feels okay. And just notice this part and acknowledge that it feels okay. And whenever you feel uncomfortable, scared, sad, anything that feels overwhelming, you can always come back to this spot that feels okay. It might be this spot, it might be another spot. And so carrying that with you, that to find a spot in your body where you feel okay. This is a technique we use a lot with pain, especially with headaches. So if you have a headache, you find a part in your body that feels okay, and just that switching of the focus. So that's one thing I'd like to share. The other I'd like to share is that one of the number one tips again, or how would I describe this? So when we're in a traumatic experience, we lose the ability to really orient to where we are in space. That's what a flashback is. That's what a trigger is. And so if you feel overwhelmed by emotion, what I'd like to suggest is a technique we call orienting. So notice that feeling and then see if you can find in the room where you are three blue objects. And you name them. Two red objects, and you name them. And one yellow object, and you name it. And this is a grounding technique, because trauma can't kind of overwhelm you if you're orienting. It's mm-hmm. a different part of the nervous system. It's the difference between the vasovagal, and it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. But all you need to know is three red, two blue, and one yellow. So I guess those are the tricks that I'd like to leave people with, because they're simple enough, but very profound.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think there's a whole lot of people that maybe if you haven't considered meditation or these meditative, you know, kind of mindfulness techniques, probably, you know, explore it now, because now, like, this world that we're in, this situation that we're in is different, you know, so trying to say that it's fine, it's normal, it's not normal, you know, we're not dealing with normal. And, right. And meditation has a lot of research behind it, that it does help re-regulate that nervous system. And so I'm, you know, for people that are listening to this, like, try these things. I know you've never done them before. I know they sound a little weird to think about the tip of your nose or your pinky finger or to name colors, but they really do have merit to them. They have a basis to them. And when you give them a shot, give them a try, you know, they will actually do something for you. They will get that calming a re-regulation that we're trying to really get out of this, to get us out of this super hyper aroused state. And so I think that, you know, this whole thing with this pandemic is really introducing the concept of meditation to people that never even thought about it before and never considered it. And so this is a, you know, your suggestions, Liz, are, you know, just simple forms of a way that, you know, and then if you want to explore it bigger and you want to sit down on your floor and really kind of, like, you know, get your, you know, fingers together and ready to go. Awesome. But we can all do these other things that have, you know, can really do make a huge difference on shifting gears. And God, I mean, I feel it when you're talking, your voice is so nice. I'm going to just let that one, like, go, like, just calm down, sit there listening to you as you were going through that. So anyways, that's, mm-hmm. those are some great things. So,
well, so Liz, glad.
Go ahead.
People, there's, Yeah, I have more. I have a meditation script. I have some suggestions on my website. So I have some more tools there too.
Cool. And those will be linked in so everybody can get to those off of the podcast notes when you guys are listening to this. And again, if anybody's jumping in on it, you're probably, this is a soft start to season three because it feels like it's important to do that right now. Like I said, at the
yeah,
the
I love that here. Word soft. Soft is so important, right? It's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways. And I appreciate you and that you and I were able to sit here and do this and to speak with your experiences. And I think that, I really did feel at the beginning of this, the pain, especially of being in the New York area, coming mm-hmm. out of you. And so you have my, God, like my compassion and my heart for you mm-hmm. and everybody in this dealing with this, being in a very red hot zone of all of this, it's profoundly, God, it's profoundly hard. I can't even imagine. So I hang in there. Like I'm with you. And I think that we all have to listen to that and hear that there are parts of this country that have not had to deal with this to the extent that some people are in dealing with it. And I think we all have to be compassionate about that. And I think that's what kind of hurts is to see some people not appear to understand how deeply painful and scary and frightening and angry and frustrating this really is for a variety of different reasons. And it's really important right now that if we can tap that compassion back in and bring ourselves to understanding everybody else's experiences. And so I appreciate you sharing that because it looked vulnerable and it felt vulnerable here on my side. And I think that's important for other people to understand. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quirconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.